The Life of Chuck. Act 3. Thanks, Chuck. Chapter 1. The day Marty Anderson saw the billboard was just before the internet finally went down for good. It had been wobbling for 8 months since the first short interruptions. Everyone agreed it was only a matter of time, and everyone agreed they would muddle through somehow once the wired-in world finally went dark. After all, they had managed without it, hadn't they? Besides, there were other problems, like whole species of birds and fish dying off, and now there was California to think about, going, possibly soon to be gone. Marty was late leaving school, because it was that least favorite day for high school educators, the one set aside for parent-teacher conferences. As this one had played out, Marty had found few parents interested in discussing little Johnny and little Janie's progress, or lack of it. Mostly they wanted to discuss the probable final failure of the internet, which would sink their Facebook and Instagram accounts for good. None of them mentioned Pornhub, but Marty suspected many of the parents who showed up, female as well as male, were mourning that site's impending extinction as well. Ordinarily, Marty would have driven home by way of the Turnpike bypass, zippity-zip, home in a jiff, but that wasn't possible due to the collapse of the bridge over Otter Creek. That had happened 4 months ago, and there was no sign of repairs, just orange-striped wooden barriers that already looked dingy and were covered with Taggers logos. With the bypass closed, Marty was forced to drive directly through downtown to reach his house on Cedar Court, along with everybody else who lived on the east side. Thanks to the conferences, he'd left at 5 instead of 3 at the height of rush hour, and a drive that would have taken 20 minutes in the old days would take at least an hour, probably longer because some of the traffic lights were out as well. It was stop and go all the way, with plenty of horns, screeching brakes, bumper kisses, and waved middle fingers. He was stopped for 10 minutes at the intersection of Main and Market, so had plenty of time to notice the billboard on top of the Midwest Trust Building. Until today, it had advertised one of the airlines, Delta or Southwest, Marty couldn't remember which. This afternoon, the happy crew of arm-in-arm flight attendants had been replaced by a photograph of a moon-faced man with black-framed glasses that matched his black, neatly combed hair. He was sitting at a desk with a pen in his hand, jacketless, but with his tie carefully knotted at the collar of his white shirt. On the hand holding the pen, there was a crescent-shaped scar that had for some reason not been airbrushed out. To Marty, he looked like an accountant. He was smiling cheerfully down at the snarled twilight traffic from his perch high atop the bank building. Above his head in blue was Charles Krantz. Below his desk in red was 39 great years. Thanks, Chuck. Marty had never heard of Charles Chuck Krantz, but supposed he must have been a pretty big bug at Midwest Trust to rate a retirement photo on a spotlit billboard that had to be at least 15 feet high and 50 feet across. And the photo must be an old one, if he'd put in almost 40 years, or his hair would have been white. "Or gone," Marty said and brushed at his own thinning thatch. He took a chance at downtown's main intersection 5 minutes later when a momentary hole opened up. He squirted his Prius through it, tensing for a collision and ignoring the shaken fist of a man who squelched to a stop only inches from T-boning him. There was another tie-up at the top of Main Street and another close call. By the time he got home, he had forgotten all about the billboard. He drove into the garage, pushed the button that lowered the door, and then just sat for a full minute, breathing deeply and trying not to think about having to run the same gauntlet tomorrow morning. With the bypass closed, there was just no other choice. If he wanted to go to work at all, that was, and right then taking a sick day, he had plenty of them stacked up, seemed like a more attractive option. "I wouldn't be the only one," he told the empty garage. He knew this to be true. According to the New York Times, which he read on his tablet every morning if the internet was working, absenteeism was at a worldwide high. He grabbed his stack of books with one hand and his battered old briefcase with the other. It was heavy with papers that would need correcting. Thus burdened, he struggled out of the car and closed the door with his butt. The sight of his shadow on the wall doing something that looked like a funky dance move made him laugh. The sound startled him. Laughter in these difficult days was hard to come by. Then he dropped half of his books on the garage floor, which put an end to any nascent good humor. He gathered up Introduction to American Literature and four short novels. He was currently teaching The Red Badge of Courage to his sophomores, and went inside. He had barely managed to get everything on the kitchen counter before the phone rang. The landline, of course. There was hardly any cell coverage these days. He sometimes congratulated himself on keeping his landline when so many of his colleagues had given theirs up. Those folks were truly hung, because getting one put in this last year or so, forget about it. You'd be more likely to be using the turnpike bypass again before you got to the top of the waiting list, and even the landlines now had frequent outages. Caller ID no longer worked, but he was sure enough about who was on the other end to simply pick up the phone and say, "Yo, Felicia." "Where have you been?" his ex-wife asked him. "I've been trying to reach you for an hour." Marty explained about the parent-teacher conferences and the long trip home. "Are you okay?"
"I will be, as soon as I get something to eat. How are you, Fel?"
"I'm getting along, but we had six more today." Marty didn't have to ask her six more of what. Felicia was a nurse at City General, where the nursing staff now called itself the Suicide Squad.
"Sorry to hear that."
"Sign of the times."
He could hear the shrug in her voice and thought that 2 years ago, when they'd still been married, six suicides in one day would have left her shaken, heartbroken, and sleepless. But you could get used to anything, it seemed.
"Are you still taking your ulcer medication, Marty?"
Before he could reply, she hurried on.
"It's not nagging, just concern. Divorce doesn't mean I still don't care about you, you know?"
"I know. And I am."
This was half a lie, because the doctor-prescribed Carafate was now impossible to get, and he was relying on Prilosec. He told the half-lie because he still cared about her, too. They actually got along better now that they weren't married anymore. There was even sex, and although it was infrequent, it was pretty damn good.
"I appreciate you asking."
"Really?"
"Yes, ma'am."
He opened the fridge. Pickings were slim, but there were hot dogs, a few eggs, and a can of blueberry yogurt he would save for a pre-bedtime snack. Also, three cans of hams.
"Good.
How many parents actually showed up?"
"More than I expected. Far less than a full house. Mostly they wanted to talk about the internet. They seemed to think I should know why it keeps shitting the bed. I had to keep telling them I'm an English teacher, not an IT guy."
"You know about California, right?" Lowering her voice as if imparting a great secret.
"Yes."
That morning, a gigantic earthquake, the third in the last month and by far the worst, had sent another large chunk of the Golden State into the Pacific Ocean. The good news was that most of that part of the state had been evacuated. The bad news was that now hundreds of thousands of refugees were trekking east, turning Nevada into one of the most populous states in the Union. Gasoline in Nevada currently costs $20 a gallon, cash only,
and if the station wasn't tapped out. Marty grabbed a half-empty quart of milk, sniffed, and drank from the bottle in spite of the faintly suspicious aroma. He needed a real drink, but knew from bitter experience and sleepless nights that he had to insulate his stomach first. He said, "It's interesting to me that the parents who did show up seemed more concerned about the internet than the California quakes. I suppose because the state's breadbasket regions are still there. But for how long? I heard a scientist on NPR say that California is peeling away like old wallpaper, and another Japanese reactor got inundated this afternoon. They're saying it was shut down, all's well, but I don't think I believe that."
Cynic.
"We're living in cynical times, Marty." She hesitated. "Some people think we're living in the last times. Not just the religious crazies, either. Not anymore. You heard that from a member in good standing of the city general suicide squad. We lost 6 today, true, but there were 18 more we dragged back, most with the help of naloxone, but..." She lowered her voice again. "Supplies of that are getting very thin. I heard the head pharmacist saying we might be completely out by the end of the month."
"That sucks," Marty said, eyeing his briefcase. "All those papers waiting to be processed. All those spelling errors waiting to be corrected. All those dangling subordinate clauses and vague conclusions waiting to be red-inked. Computer crutches like spell check and apps like Grammar Alert didn't seem to help. Just thinking of it made him tired. Listen, Fel, I ought to go. I have tests to grade and essays on mending wall to correct." The thought of the stacked vapidities in those waiting essays made him feel old. "All right," Felicia said. "Just, you know, touching base." "Roger that."
Marty opened the cupboard and took down the bourbon. He would wait until she was off the phone to pour it, lest she hear the glugging and know what he was doing. Wives had intuition. Ex-wives seemed to develop high-def radar.
"Could I say I love you?" she asked.
"Only if I can say it right back," Marty replied, running his finger over the label on the bottle. Early times. A very good brand, he thought, for these later times.
"I love you, Marty."
"And I love you."
A good place to end, but she was still there.
"Marty?"
"What, hon?"
"The world is going down the drain, and all we can say is, that sucks. So maybe we're going down the drain, too."
"Maybe we are," he said. "But Chuck Krantz is retiring, so I guess there's a gleam of light in the darkness."
39 great years, she responded, and it was her turn to laugh. He put the milk down.
"You saw the billboard?"
"No, it was an ad on the radio, that NPR show I was telling you about."
"If they're running ads on NPR, it really is the end of the world," Marty said.
She laughed again, and the sound made him glad.
"Tell me, how does Chuck Krantz rate this kind of coverage? He looks like an accountant, and I never heard of him."
"No idea. The world is full of mysteries." "No hard stuff, Marty. I know you're thinking of it. Have a beer instead."
He didn't laugh as he ended the call, but he smiled. Ex-wife radar. High def.
He put the early times back in the cupboard and grabbed a beer instead. He plopped a couple of hot dogs into water and went into his little study to see if the internet was up while he waited for the water to boil. It was, and seemed to be running at slightly better than its usual slow crawl. He went to Netflix, thinking he might rewatch an episode of Breaking Bad or The Wire while he ate his dogs. The welcome screen came up, showing selections that hadn't changed since last evening, and the stuff on Netflix used to change just about every day not so long ago.
But before he could decide on which bad guy he wanted to watch, Walter White or Stringer Bell, the welcome screen disappeared. Searching appeared, and the little worry circle. Fuck, Marty said. Gone for the night. Then the worry circle disappeared, and the screen came back. Only it wasn't the Netflix welcome screen. It was Charles Krantz, sitting at his paper-strewn desk, smiling with his pen in his scarred hand. Charles Krantz above him. 39 great years. Thanks, Chuck. Below. Who the fuck are you, Chucky? Marty asked. How do you rate? And then, as if his breath had blown out the internet like a birthday candle, the picture disappeared and the words on the screen were, "Connection lost." It did not come back that night. Like half of California, soon to be three quarters, the internet had vanished. The first thing Marty noticed the next day as he backed his car out of the garage was the sky. How long had it been since he had seen that clear, unblemished blue? A month? 6 weeks? The clouds and the rain, sometimes a drizzle, sometimes a torrent, were almost constant now, and on days when the clouds cleared, the sky usually remained bleary from the smoke of fires in the Midwest. They had blackened most of Iowa and Nebraska and were moving on to Kansas, driven by gale force winds. The second thing he noticed was Gus Wilfong trudging up the street with his oversized lunchbox banging against his thigh. Gus was wearing khakis, but with a tie. He was a supervisor at the city's public works department. Although it was only 7:15, he looked tired and out of sorts, as if at the end of a long day instead of just starting one. And if he was just starting one, why was he walking toward his house next door to Marty's? Also, Marty powered down his window. Where's your car? Gus's short laugh was humorless. Parked on the sidewalk halfway down Main Street Hill, along with about 100 others. He blew out his breath. Ooh, I can't remember the last time I walked 3 miles, which probably says more about me than you want to know. If you're going to school, buddy, you're going to have to go all the way out Route 11 and then hook back on Route 19. 20 miles at least, and there'll be plenty of traffic there, too. You might arrive in time for lunch, but I wouldn't count on it. What happened? Sinkhole opened up at the intersection of Main and Market. Man, it's huge. All the rain we've been having might have something to do with it. Lack of maintenance, probably even more. Not my department, thank God. Gotta be 20 cars at the bottom of it, maybe 30, and some of the people in those cars. He shook his head. They ain't coming back. Jesus, Marty said. I was just there last evening, backed up in traffic. Be glad you weren't there this morning. Mind if I get in with you? Sit down for a minute? I'm pooped, and Jenny will have gone back to bed. I don't want to wake her up, especially with bad news. Sure. Gus got in the car. This is bad, my friend. It sucks, Marty agreed. It was what he'd said to Felicia last night. Just gotta grin and bear it, I guess. I'm not grinning, Gus said. Planning to take the day off? Gus raised his hands and brought them down on the lunchbox in his lap. I don't know. Maybe I'll make some calls, see if someone can pick me up. But I'm not hopeful. If you do take the day, don't plan to spend it watching Netflix or YouTube videos. Internet's down again, and I've got a feeling it might be for good this time. I'm assuming you know about California, Gus said. I didn't turn on the TV this morning. Slept in a bit. He paused. Didn't want to watch it anyway, to tell you the truth. Is there something new?
Yeah. The rest of it went.
He reconsidered.
Well, they're saying 20% of Northern California is still hanging in there, which means probably 10. But the food-producing regions are gone.
That's terrible. It was, of course, but instead of horror and terror and grief, all Marty felt was a kind of benumbed dismay.
You could say that, Gus agreed. Especially with the Midwest turning to charcoal and the southern half of Florida now basically swampland, fit only for alligators. I hope you've got a lot of food in your pantry and freezer, because now all the major food-producing regions of this country are gone. Same with Europe. It's already famine time in Asia. Millions dead there. Bubonic plague, I'm hearing.
They sat in Marty's driveway, watching more people walking back from downtown, many dressed in suits and ties. A woman in a pretty pink suit was trudging along in sneakers, carrying her heels in one hand. Marty thought her name was Andrea something, lived a street or two over. Hadn't Felicia told him she worked at Midwest Trust?
And the bees, Gus continued. They were in trouble even 10 years ago, but now they're completely gone, except for a few hives down in South America. No more honey, honey. And without them to pollinate whatever crops might be left.
Excuse me, Marty said. He got out of the car and trotted to catch up with the woman in the pink suit.
Andrea? Are you Andrea?
She turned warily, lifting her shoes as if she might have to use one of the heels to ward him off. Marty understood. There were plenty of loosely wrapped people around these days. He stopped 5 feet away.
I'm Felicia Anderson's husband.
Ex, actually, but husband sounded less potentially dangerous.
I think you and Fel know each other.
We do. I was on the neighborhood watch committee with her. What can I do for you, Mr. Anderson? I've had a long walk and my car's stuck in what appears to be a terminal traffic jam downtown. As for the bank, it's leaning.
Leaning? Marty repeated. In his mind, he saw an image of the Leaning Tower of Pisa, with Chuck Krantz's retirement photo on top.
It's on the edge of the sinkhole, and although it hasn't fallen in, it looks very unsafe to me. Sure to be condemned. I suppose that's the end of my job, at least in the downtown branch, but I don't really care. I just want to go home and put my feet up.
I was curious about the billboard on the bank building. Have you seen it?
How could I miss it? She asked. I work there, after all. I've seen the graffiti, which is everywhere. We love you, Chuck. Chuck lives. Chuck forever. And the ads on TV.
Really? Marty thought of what he'd seen on Netflix last night, just before it went away. At the time, he dismissed it as a particularly annoying pop-up ad.
Well, the local stations, anyway. Maybe it's different on cable, but we don't get that anymore. Not since July.
Us either.
Now that he had begun the fiction that he was still part of an us, it seemed best to carry on with it. Just Channel 8 and Channel 10. Andrea nodded.
No more ads for Cars or Eliquis or Bob's Discount Furniture. Just Charles Krantz, 39 great years, thanks, Chuck. A full minute of that, then back to our regularly scheduled reruns. Very peculiar, but these days, what isn't? Now, I really want to get home.
This Charles Krantz isn't associated with your bank?
Retiring from the bank? She paused for just a moment before continuing her homeward trudge, carrying high heels she would not need that day, perhaps ever again.
I don't know Charles Krantz from Adam. He must have worked in the Omaha headquarters. Although, from what I understand, Omaha is just a great big ashtray these days.
Marty watched her go. So did Gus Wilfong, who had joined him. Gus nodded at the glum parade of returning workers who could no longer get to their jobs, selling, trading, banking, waiting on tables, making deliveries.
They look like refugees, Gus said.
Yeah, Marty said, they kind of do. Hey, you remember asking me about my food supplies? Gus nodded. I have quite a few cans of soup, also some basmati and rice-a-roni, Cheerios, I believe. As for the freezer, I think I might have 6 TV dinners and half a pint of Ben & Jerry's.
You don't sound concerned.
Marty shrugged. What good would that do?
But see, it's interesting, Gus said. We were all concerned at first. We wanted answers. People went to Washington and protested. Remember when they knocked over the White House fence and those college kids got shot?
Yeah.
There was the government overthrow in Russia and the 4-day war between India and Pakistan. There's a volcano in Germany, for Christ's sake. Germany! We told each other all this would blow over, but that doesn't seem to be happening, does it?
No, Marty agreed. Although he'd just gotten up, he felt tired. Very. Not blowing over, blowing harder.
Then there's the suicides.
Marty nodded. Felicia sees them every day.
I think the suicides will slow down, Gus said. And people will just wait.
For what?
For the end, pal. The end of everything. We've been going through the 5 stages of grief. Don't you get it? Now we've arrived at the last one. Acceptance.
Marty said nothing. He could think of nothing to say.
There's so little curiosity now, and all this...
Gus waved an arm.
It came out of nowhere. I mean, we knew the environment was going to the dogs. I think even the right-wing nutjob secretly believed in it. But this is 60 different varieties of shit all at once.
He gave Marty a look that was almost pleading.
In how long? A year? 14 months?
Yes, Marty said.
Sucks.
It seemed to be the only word that fit. Overhead, they heard a droning sound and looked up. The big jets flying in and out of the municipal airport were few and far between these days, but this was a small plane, bumbling along in the unusually clear sky and belching a stream of white from its tail. The plane twisted and banked, rose and fell, the smoke, or whatever chemical it was, forming letters.
Huh, Gus said, craning. Skyriding plane. Haven't seen one since I was a kid.
Charles, the plane wrote. Then Krantz, and then, of course, 39 great years. The name was already starting to fuzz out as the plane wrote, Thanks, Chuck.
What the fuck? Gus said.
My sentiments exactly, Marty said. He had skipped breakfast, so when he went back inside, Marty microwaved one of his frozen dinners, a Marie Callender's chicken pot pie, quite tasty, and took it into the living room to watch TV. But the only 2 stations he could pull in were showing the photograph of Charles Chuck Krantz sitting at his desk with his pen at the eternal ready. Marty stared at it while he ate his pot pie, then killed the idiot box and went back to bed. It seemed the most sensible thing to do. He slept for most of the day, and although he didn't dream of her, at least that he could remember, he woke up thinking of Felicia. He wanted to see her, and when he did, he would ask if he could sleep over, maybe even stay. 60 different varieties of shit, Gus had said, and all at once. If this really was the end, he didn't want to face it alone. Harvest Acres, the tidy little development where Felicia now lived, was 3 miles away, and Marty had no intention of risking the drive in his car, so he put on his sweatpants and sneakers. It was a beautiful late afternoon for walking, the sky still an unblemished blue, and plenty of people were out and about. A few looked as if they were enjoying the sunshine, but most just looked down at their feet. There was little talk, even among those who were walking in pairs or trios. On Park Drive, one of the East Side's main thoroughfares, all four lanes were jammed with cars, most of them empty. Marty wove his way between them, and on the other side encountered an elderly man in a tweed suit and matching Trilby hat. He was sitting on the curb and knocking his pipe out into the gutter. He saw Marty watching him and smiled.
"Just taking a rest," he said. "I walked downtown to look at the sinkhole and take a few pictures with my phone. Thought one of the local television stations might be interested, but they all seemed to be off the air. Except for pictures of that fellow Krantz, that is."
"Yes," Marty said. "It's all Chuck all the time now."
"Any idea who?"
"None. I've asked 24 people at least. Nobody knows. Our man Krantz appears to be the Oz of the apocalypse."
Marty laughed.
"Where are you heading, sir?"
"Harvest Acres. Nice little enclave off the beaten track."
He reached into his jacket, produced a pouch of tobacco, and began reloading his pipe.
"I'm going there myself. My ex lives there. Maybe we could walk together?"
The elderly gent got up with a wince.
"As long as you don't rush along."
He lit his pipe, puffing away.
"Arthritis. I have pills for it, but the more the arthritis sets in, the less they do."
"Sucks," Marty said. "You set the pace."
The old guy did. It was a slow one. His name was Samuel Yarbrough. He was owner and chief undertaker of the Yarbrough Funeral Home.
"But my real interest is meteorology," he said. "Dreamed of being a television weatherman in my salad days, perhaps even on one of the networks, but they all seem to have a pash for young women with..."
He put his cupped hands in front of his chest.
"I keep up, though, read the journals, and I can tell you an amazing thing, if you want to hear."
"Sure."
They came to a bus bench. Stenciled on the back was Charles Chuck Krantz, 39 great years. "Thanks, Chuck." Sam Yarbrough took a seat and patted the space next to him. Marty sat. It was downwind of Yarbrough's pipe, but that was okay. Marty liked the smell.
"Do you know how people say there's 24 hours in a day?"
Yarbrough asked.
"And 7 days in a week. Everybody knows that, even little kids."
"Well, everybody is wrong. There were 23 hours and 56 minutes in a stellar day, plus a few odd seconds."
"Were?"
"Correct. Based on my calculations, which I assure you I can back up, there are now 24 hours and 2 minutes in a day. Do you know what that means, Mr. Anderson?"
Marty thought it over. "Are you telling me the Earth's rotation is slowing down?"
"Exactly."
Yarbrough took his pipe out of his mouth and gestured at the people passing them on the sidewalk. Their numbers were thinning now that afternoon had begun to edge into twilight.
"I'll bet many of those folks think the multiple disasters we're facing have a single cause rooted in what we have done to the Earth's environment. It's not so. I would be the first to admit that we have treated our mother, yes, she's the mother of us all, very badly, certainly molested her, if not outright raped her. But we're puny compared to the great clock of the universe. Puny. No, whatever is happening is much larger than environmental degradation."
"Maybe it's Chuck Krantz's fault," Marty said.
Yarbrough looked at him in surprise, then laughed.
"Back to him, huh?
Chuck Krantz is retiring and the entire population of Earth, not to mention the Earth itself, is retiring with him. Is that your thesis?
Gotta blame something, Marty said, smiling. Or someone. Sam Yarbrough stood up, put a hand to the small of his back, stretched and winced.
With apologies to Mr. Spock, that's illogical. I suppose 39 years is quite a span in terms of human life, almost half, but the last ice age happened quite a bit longer ago, not to mention the age of the dinosaurs. Shall we mosey?
They moseyed, their shadows stretching ahead of them. Marty was mentally scolding himself for having slept away the best part of a beautiful day. Yarbrough was moving ever more slowly. When they finally reached the brick arch marking the entrance to Harvest Acres, the old mortician sat down again.
I think I'll watch the sunset while I wait for the arthritis to settle a bit. Would you care to join me?
Marty shook his head.
Think I'll go on.
Check the X, Yarbrough said. I understand. It was nice speaking with you, Mr. Anderson.
Marty started beneath the arch, then turned back.
Charles Krantz means something, he said.
I'm sure of it.
You could be right, Sam said, puffing on his pipe. But the slowing of the Earth's rotation, nothing's bigger than that, my friend.
The central thoroughfare of the Harvest Acres development was a graceful tree-lined parabola from which shorter trees diverged. The streetlights, which looked to Marty like those in illustrated Dickens novels, had come on, casting a moonlight glow. As Marty approached Fern Lane, where Felicia lived, a little girl on roller skates appeared, banking gracefully around the corner. She was wearing baggy red shorts and a sleeveless tee with somebody's face on it, maybe a rock star or a rapper. Marty guessed her age at 10 or 11, and seeing her cheered him enormously. A little girl on roller skates. What could be more normal in this abnormal day, this abnormal year?
Yo,
he said.
Yo,
she agreed, but turned neatly on her skates, perhaps ready to flee if he turned out to be one of the Chester the Molester types her mother had no doubt warned her about.
I'm going to see my ex-wife, Marty said, standing where he was. Felicia Anderson?
Or maybe she's back to Gordon now. That was her maiden name. She lives on Fern Lane, number 19. The little girl pivoted on her skates, an effortless move that would have left Marty flat on his ass.
Oh, yeah. Maybe I've seen you before. Blue Prius?
That's me.
If you come to see her, why is she your ex?
Still like her.
You don't fight?
We used to. We get along better now that we're exes.
Ms. Gordon gives us ginger snap cookies sometimes. Me and my little brother Ronnie, I like Oreos better, but...
But that's the way the cookie crumbles, right? Marty said.
Nah, ginger snaps don't crumble, at least not until you crunch them up in your mouth.
At that moment, the streetlights went out, turning the main drag into a lagoon of shadows. All the houses went dark at the same time. There had been outages in the city before, some as long as 18 hours, but the power had always come back. Marty wasn't sure it would this time. Maybe. But he had a feeling that electricity, which he and everyone else had taken for granted all his life, might have gone the way of the internet.
Booger,
said the little girl.
You better go home, Marty said. With no streetlights, it's too dark for skating. Mister, is everything going to be all right?
Although he had no kids of his own, he taught them for 20 years and felt that, although you should tell them the truth once they reach the age of 16, a kind-hearted lie was often the right way to go when they were as young as this girl.
Sure.
But look, she said and pointed. He followed her trembling finger to the house on the corner of Fern Lane. A face was appearing on the darkened bay window overlooking a small patch of lawn. It appeared in glowing white lines and shadows, like ectoplasm at a seance. Smiling moon face, black framed glasses, pen poised. Over it, Charles Krantz. Below it, 39 great years. Thanks, Chuck.
It's happening to all of them, she whispered.
She was right. Chuck Krantz was rising on the front windows of every house on Fern Lane. Marty turned and saw an arc of Krantz faces stretching out behind him on the main avenue. Dozens of Chucks, maybe hundreds, thousands if this phenomenon was happening all over the city.
Go home, Marty said, not smiling anymore.
Go home to your mom and dad, Poppet. Do it right now. She skated away, her skates rumbling on the sidewalk and her hair flying out behind her. He could see the red shorts, then she was lost in the thickening shadows. Marty walked quickly in the direction she had gone, observed by the smiling face of Charles Chuck Krantz in every window. Chuck in his white shirt and dark tie. It was like being watched by a horde of ghost clones. Marty was glad there was no moon. What if Chuck's face had appeared there? How would he deal with that? He gave up walking at number 13. He ran the rest of the way to Felicia's little two-room bungalow, pounded up the front walk and knocked on the door. He waited, suddenly sure she was still at the hospital, maybe working a double. But then he heard her footsteps. The door opened, she was holding a candle. It underlit her frightened face.
Marty, thank God. Do you see them?
Yes. The guy was in her front window, too. Chuck, smiling, looking like every accountant who ever lived. A man who wouldn't say boo to a goose.
They just started showing up.
I know. I saw.
Is it just here?
I think it's everywhere. I think it's almost... Then she was hugging him, pulling him inside. And he was glad she hadn't given him a chance to say the other two words. The end.
Chapter 2. Douglas Beaton, associate professor of philosophy in Ithaca College's Department of Philosophy and Religion, sits in a hospital room waiting for his brother-in-law to die. The only sounds are the steady bip, bip, of the heart monitor, and Chuck's slow and increasingly labored breathing. Most of the machinery has been turned off.
Unc?
Doug turns to see Brian in the doorway, still wearing his letter jacket and backpack.
You left school early? Doug asks.
With permission, Mom texted me that she was going to let them turn off the machines.
Did they?
Yes.
When?
An hour ago.
Where's Mom now?
In the chapel on the first floor. She's praying for his soul. And probably praying she did the right thing, Doug thinks. Because even when the priest tells you yes, it's fine, let God take care of the rest, it feels wrong somehow.
I'm supposed to text her if it looks like he's...
Brian's uncle shrugs. Brian approaches the bed and looks down at his father's still white face. With his black-framed glasses put aside, the boy thinks his dad doesn't look old enough to have a son who's a freshman in high school. He looks like a high school kid himself. He picks up his father's hand and plants a brief kiss on the crescent-shaped scar there.
Guys as young as him aren't supposed to die, Brian says.
He speaks softly, as if his father can hear.
Jesus, Uncle Doug, he just turned 39 last winter.
Come sit down, Doug says, and pats the empty chair next to him.
That's Mom's seat.
When she comes back, you can give it to her. Brian shucks his backpack and sits down.
How long do you think it will be?
The doctor said he could go any time, before tomorrow, almost certainly. You know the machines were helping him breathe, right? And there were IVs to feed him. He's not... Brian, he's not in any pain. That part is over. Glioblastoma, Brian says bitterly. When he turns to his uncle, he's crying.
Why would God take my dad, Uncle Doug? Explain it to me.
I can't. God's ways are a mystery.
Well, fuck the mystery, the boy says. Mysteries should stay in storybooks where they belong.
Uncle Doug nods and puts an arm around Brian's shoulders. I know it's hard, kiddo. It's hard for me, too, but it's all I got. Life's a mystery. So is death. They fall silent, listening to the steady bip, 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 and the rasp as Charles Krantz, Chuck to his wife and his wife's brother and his friends, takes one slow breath after another. His body's last interactions with the world, each inhale and exhale managed like the beat of his heart by a failing brain where a few operations still continue. The man who spent his working life in the accounting department of the Midwest Trust is now doing his final tallies. Small income, large disbursements. Banks are supposed to be heartless, but they really loved him there, Brian says. They sent a ton of flowers. The nurses put them in that solarium thing because he's not supposed to have flowers. What did they think? That it was going to kick off an allergy attack or something?
He loved working there, Doug says. It wasn't a big deal in the grand scheme of things, I suppose. He was never going to win a Nobel Prize or get a Medal of Freedom from the president, but he did love it.
Dancing, too, Brian says. He loved dancing. He was good. So was Mom. They could really cut a rug, she used to say. But she also said he was better.
Doug laughs. Used to call himself the poor man's Fred Astaire. And model trains when he was a boy. His Zadie had a set. You know, his granddad.
Yeah, Brian says. I know about his Zadie.
He had a good life, Bri.
Not enough of it, Brian says. He'll never get to take the train across Canada like he wanted to. Or visit Australia. He wanted that, too. He's never going to see me graduate high school. He's never going to have a retirement party where people make funny speeches and give him a gold.
He wiped his eyes on the sleeve of his jacket.
A gold watch.
Doug squeezes his nephew's shoulders. Brian speaks, looking down at his clasped hands.
I want to believe in God, Unc, and I sort of do, but I don't understand why it has to be this way. Why God would let it be this way. It's a mystery? You're the hotshot philosophy guy, and that's the best you can do?
Yes, because death brings philosophy to ruin, Doug thinks. You know what they say, Brian. Death takes the best of us, and death takes the rest of us. Brian tries to smile.
If that's supposed to be comforting, you need to try harder.
Doug seems not to have heard. He's looking at his brother-in-law, who is, in Doug's mind, an actual brother, who has given his sister a good life, who helped him get his start in business, and that's really the least of it. They had some fine times together. Not enough, but it looks like they'll have to do. The human brain is finite, no more than a sponge of tissue inside a cage of bone. But the mind within the brain is infinite. Its storage capacity is colossal, its imaginative reach beyond our ability to comprehend. I think when a man or woman dies,
A whole world falls to ruin. The world that person knew and believed in. Think of that, kiddo. Billions of people on Earth, and each one of those billions with a world inside. The Earth their minds have conceived. And now my dad's world is dying.
But not ours, Doug says and gives his nephew another squeeze. Ours will go on a little while longer. And your mother's. We need to be strong for her, Brian. As strong as we can.
They fall silent, looking at the dying man in the hospital bed, listening to the bip, bip, bip of the monitor and the slow breaths Chuck Krantz inhales and exhales. Once it stops, his chest remains flat. Brian tenses. Then it rises again with another of those agonal rasps.
Text Mom, Brian says. Right now.
Doug already has his phone out.
Way ahead of you.
And types, better come, sis. Brian is here. I think Chuck is near the end.
Chapter 3. Marty and Felicia went out on the back lawn. They sat in chairs they carried down from the patio. The power was out all over the city now, and the stars were very bright, brighter than Marty had ever seen them since he was a boy growing up in Nebraska. Back then, he'd had a small telescope and conned the universe from his attic window.
There's Aquila, he said, the eagle. There's Cygnus, the swan. See it?
Yes. And there's the North Star. She stopped. Marty, did you see?
Yes, he said. It just went out.
And there goes Mars. Goodbye, Red Planet.
Marty, I'm scared.
Was Gus Wilfong looking up at the sky tonight? Andrea, the woman who'd been on the neighborhood watch committee with Felicia. Samuel Yarbrough, the undertaker. What about the little girl in the red shorts?
Starlight, star bright, last stars I see tonight.
Marty took her hand.
I am too.
Chapter 4. Ginny, Brian, and Doug stand beside Chuck Krantz's bed, their hands joined. They wait as Chuck, husband, father, accountant, dancer, fan of TV crime shows, takes his last two or three breaths.
39 years, Doug says. 39 great years. Thanks, Chuck.
Chapter 5. Marty and Felicia sat with their faces turned up to the sky, watching the stars go out. First in ones and twos, then by the dozens, then by the hundreds. As the Milky Way rolled away into darkness, Marty turned to his ex-wife.
I love black.